Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. In this episode, I'm talking to Margot Villeron about her literary novel, The Yellow Kitchen. Margot is a French-born, London-based writer and translation rights agent. She is a self-taught cook and co-host of the Salmon Pink Kitchen Book Club, culinary community and podcast. In this episode, we talk about the freedom and pleasure of writing in a second language, how she used her own diaries to write about the political landscape of 2019, and the unusual way she inhabits her characters, by texting herself in character. But before we get into that, here's Margot with an excerpt from The Yellow Kitchen.
On Sundays, we bathed. We ran a long bath, squeezed all the leftover soaps from the ending week together, whizzed our hands through the water making bubbles, shy laughter emerging from my tiny body, and a nodding smile shaping on my mother's face. I hopped over and into the foaming bathtub, a welcoming warm lagoon for me, and then a cold puddle for Maman. She sat on the ice-cold tiles, topless, her hair roughly held up with a clasp, and read Jack London's The Call of the Wild to me as I submerged myself in water. She never missed a Sunday. Dimanche soir was the one moment when the world would turn around us as we granted ourselves intimacy. Wet hair curling down our backs, her teeth hardening, my freckles melting into the redness of my body after meeting with hot water, and Maman's blue lips afterwards. Our memories, a family album in the making. It was then that I noticed the different shades on her body, bags under her eyes and bruises inside her forearms, bruises from the long work shifts, bags under her eyes as a result of the food in the fridge that eventually got eaten, and the bills that accumulated on the wooden desk in the entrance. And me, petite Claude. Maman was alone, responsible for my aliveness. There was no rest left for her, only worrisome nights, knitting me woolen armor. Now she has retreated, with sleepy eyes and a few words left for her battles. And I move on, instincts alert, expectations high, the call of the wild. He was mastered by the sheer surging of life, the tidal wave of being, the perfect joy of each separate muscle, joint and sinew, in that it was everything that was not death, that it was aglow and rampant, expression its life in movement, flying exultantly under the stars and over the face of dead matter that did not move. I often hear small whispers in my ears as my hands meet with flour, butter, and eggs as I whisk.
Hi, Margot. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, The Yellow Kitchen.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited and really happy to be here.
So can you start by telling us what The Yellow Kitchen is about?
Of course. The Yellow Kitchen is a story of three women, Claude, Sophie and Julia, as they battle through kind of being in their 20s and the crazy year 2019 was. And it's their story, those three women, their friendships and the thing they say to each other, and probably as well the things they don't say to each other, but they guess about each other. So maybe a bit of a story of coming of age and a story of friendships, really, and of culture and identity.
Mm. Do you remember what it was that inspired the novel and how that kind of idea came to you? Is it something you've been sitting with for a long time?
Mm-hmm. I think it's something maybe I have been breathing for a long time. It was, you know, I actually was writing as things were happening, and I think that's an exercise I was quite aware of what I was doing. It was really contemporary around me. I was writing in 2019 as the novel was evolving, and I had been in London then for 4 or 5 years, and you know, I was reading a lot about Brexit. I was reading a lot about how London was changing, how, you know, we were seeing the French leaving London more than any other people, and I was like, that's weird, I haven't noticed that. Or, you know, it was kind of how the media was kind of speaking about Brexit and how we were performing it in our everyday lives, and I kind of felt that disconnection, because that's probably just an individual response to it, but as a person I kind of always think about, you know, what happens behind closed door, what is the effect of all of this on the domestic, on the friendship, on the everyday, you know, what happens when you are here and you've been living in this city, or maybe you were born in London and you go and meet your Italian friends at night for a drink. Do you acknowledge Brexit? Probably not, but if you don't, you know, it probably anyway comes through your conversations and your the way you're going to be interpreting what they are saying and all these kind of things. And I was really interested by that kind of texture of the everyday and how it was being affected by everything we were living. Little did I know, though, that 2020 was about to happen to us. So now it feels a little bit even more like mind-blowing what I was doing without being aware of that. So I guess, yeah, there was an inspiration of kind of wanting to talk about these things, but through maybe just through the small things of the everyday and how all the politics of life kind of come through at home and around the table and in friendships.
Yeah, because it's inevitable that it would come up into conversation and really shape their friendship, even if it wasn't acknowledged. And I was wondering, obviously it touches so deeply on topics of Brexit and 2019 election, and also events that are happening in mainland Europe. How did you kind of approach that political undercurrent? Because did you think it was quite a controversial topic to explore? Did you think that maybe there'd be people that were hesitant to read a novel that kind of touched on those topics?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I think that worry of like maybe people not wanting to read about it came later, when I actually thought this is going to be published. As I was writing it, I was more feeling actually quite strongly about it, and for it was quite important, because I really do think that it does have some shadows to everything we do. And even though maybe we don't want to talk about this or we don't want to acknowledge it, it's quite important to do so at some point. And that's just why I love the most as well about reading and about novels. I really strongly believe in the power of novels, actually, in bringing those kind of conversations up in a more organic way in the everyday. And I felt that was quite important. So yeah, I did make a decision to do it, and I knew I wasn't going to please everyone, and I know I couldn't, but at the same time, I don't think that's what writing is for, so that's okay.
Yeah, you can't please everyone, it's impossible. So what was it like for you to go back and edit this book then? Because I imagine a lot of the editing was done during the pandemic, during kind of lockdown, when 2019 was further away from you. How did you kind of go back and make sure that the kind of conversations, and because I imagine when you were editing this, all anyone wanted to talk about was COVID-19. So how did you kind of transport yourself back to 2019 to make sure that you were I know you wrote the majority of it in 2019, but how did you kind of go back to make sure you were being true to the time?
Well, I'm a very big diarist, so I do have quite a lot of everyday details of 2019 and observations. And I remember reading a lot when I would take the tube to go to work, you know, those days when I was going to work every day as to an actual office space. And I would just sit on the tube every day and do this exercise of just writing what was going around me. So I have pages and pages and pages of Word documents of everything I have seen in the tube for probably the last 5 years,
wow.
Which are just an encyclopedia of life, really. So I would have all these kind of details, but also I'm just fundamentally quite introvert and live in my head a lot. So I have to say, disconnected from everything around me and going back in time is an exercise I quite enjoy doing. But the editing part is quite fun. There are a few things I've had to change. They weren't going to Lisbon until quite later in the process, because Lisbon is the last place I went before the pandemic. And quite frankly, I knew I was going to be able to travel for a long time, and I needed to visualize the space. And I had recent memories of it. I had quite recent photos of the place. They were supposed to go to Greece in my head at the very beginning. And I was supposed to go to Greece in May 2020. That did not happen. So, you know, they were like kind of small detail that had to change through the process, because logistically I couldn't quite make the research, or I just couldn't transport myself. But anything that involved me going back in time, I could do. I spent a lot of time reading the news back in time as well. The Guardian often tells me, be careful, you are reading this an article from over 3 years ago. But I quite enjoy doing that.
It really shows to me in this novel that, I mean, it totally makes sense to me now that you've kept this amazingly detailed diary, because your observations are so accurate and so nuanced. I mean, the kind of conversations that your characters have with other people, with other friends, they're all quite kind of left-leaning, but there's various kind of differences in their opinion, and it totally makes sense to me now that you're a very observant person in the world, and you're making all these notes about conversations or people that you've met on the tube. Suddenly clear to me now how you write. I was wondering whether you could tell us a little bit more about the three women in this novel, because friendship is just so important to them. We've got Claude, we've got Julia, we've got Sophie. Could you tell us a little bit about each of them and how their kind of dynamic plays through the novel?
Yes, I think they are very different women. What unites them is that they all see friendship as a form of family. They've all needed to see friendship as, you know, the family you choose, in different ways. You have Sophie, who was born and raised in London, and has had quite a difficult relationship with her parents because they've just been quite absent, maybe self-centered is the way of saying it. And she has had very good, comfortable material life, but she hasn't had as much emotional support. And then you have Julia, who have been living all of her life in Bologna and has had a very loving family despite their kind of quirkiness and issues. But, you know, she's always been really, really supporting on that side and always made to believe that all her dreams can happen if she puts her mind to it. And so hope she moves to London with the view to get this job and, you know, start a career and live abroad. And she's there, and Claude and Sophie just become her family while she is there. And you have Claude, who is this quiet force really of herself. She goes home and she bakes a lot. She's always there for her friends, but she hasn't had much of support in her life. Her mom has quite severe mental illness, and it's been only the two of them. You know, she was raised by a single mom, and I think that is a very peculiar force to have in life. And it really shows in her independence, and she's always seeking that, and that's her biggest pride, but also probably her biggest issue and what retained her the most. So they're all there, and, you know, they have those emotional baggage are so different. But in their kind of threesome, they have found a form of family and a network.
And one of the things, of course, that unites them is food. And the beginning scene takes place in this beautiful yellow kitchen. And so many of their moments where they're all together is usually where they're eating. I was wondering if you could sort of describe how food plays a role in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the unifier again. It's a time you have to sit down and be together. I think one can be avoidant if they don't want to talk about a subject with their friends, if they're at the pub, you know, it's loud around, or if they're on the phone, or, you know, you can just ignore someone, sadly. But once you're at the table, it's quite hard to ignore a conversation you don't want to be having. We can circle around passing the salt, we can speak about the taste of the dish for a very long time, but at some point you will have to speak about that subject you've been trying to avoid. And I think food is just such a good way to dig and to investigate into a relationship between people. So as much as, you know, they get busy and maybe they don't want to speak about everything or address issues, they always reunite around food. That's that moment where there is no going away. And it brings both comfort, but also some bigger problems.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your kind of the methods you have to create your characters, because it felt like they were incredibly fully formed women, very fleshed out. And I was wondering what kind of work you did outside of the text, whether you're someone that kind of really feels like they have to know their characters before they start writing, or did you feel that their kind of personalities and backgrounds came to you quite easily as you were writing, or was it something you kind of put a lot of work into before you started writing?
Mm-hmm. No, thank you. I'm glad you found them fully formed, because they really are to me. I miss them quite a lot. I hang out with my characters a lot. I take a lot of notes in life in general, but actually about the book I write, I take very, very little notes. There is something that makes it too frozen in time. I don't know. So I tend to just live with them a lot. I'm a big runner. I run quite a lot, pretty much every morning. And that's when I go out with my characters and we have chats. And that's kind of the initial work I will be doing when I start working on something. I just hang out with them, do nothing else. Just hang out. I will start, that's when it gets a little bit weird. I will start texting myself as if I was them. Sophie and Claude have been texting each other a lot in my head and then in my phone, which I hope never, ever gets stolen. the one detail I always know about my characters, and I can't quite explain why, other than that's just a very thing I just do in my life for myself as well, is I will know when they are born, I will know their astrological sign, and while I'm writing I tend to read their horoscope a lot. Pretty much every week I will read it, and you know, I don't, it's just for me a way to be aware that they exist, and that they're not just in my head, they have other people looking at them, if that makes sense, because I think that's the hardest part at some point, is for your characters that you're writing, for them not to just be seen for your perspective, because you might have a certain opinion of them, but that doesn't define them. That's just how you see them. That's not who they are. And I find that's the hardest part, is to actually to accept to just let go of the version you have of themselves and just let them be who they would be even if you weren't there in the room anymore.
I've never heard anyone using kind of star signs and their birthdays and things to inspire their creation. That's so interesting. And I love this idea of kind of seeing them how other people see them. I think it's sometimes hard when you're so, I mean, we're all, when we're writing, kind of in our own heads about it. But it's kind of removing ourselves from it and trying to see them, because I think the only way to make them fully formed is to kind of think of them as real people. So maybe we should all start kind of texting ourselves as our own characters.
Yeah, of course. I think that's the hardest thing as well, right? It's because if they start becoming people, they will start disappointing you as well. And I think that's where I know that I start to really, they start to be people, is if I start, you know, writing something and being like, oh, for fuck's sake, Claude. Like, you know, if I start like just being like, oh my God, or if I text or something and I'm just like, this is so annoying. Like literally, if you were my friend, I would be quite annoyed that you're annoying now, but I wouldn't tell you. And that's how I accept it. Okay, they're becoming someone. That's fine. They're not just in my head. They're not just a version of me or something like that. They are becoming their people.
Did you find that then they were kind of almost talking themselves without you having too much impact? I know some people have found that they're almost just like a vessel for their characters to speak through.
Yes, absolutely. My best friend with whom I run a book club and a podcast very kindly interviewed me when we released when I published The Yellow Kitchen, and it was really interesting because she reminded me that the thing I kept saying when I was writing it, because she would ask me, you know, are you planning what's going to happen next? And I kept on saying, oh, I will see where they take me next. And that's really become, I think, my motto and what I'm trying to keep doing as I try to write more, and even in different forms, is trying to see where this will take me next and where they will take me next. And it might not be where I wanted them to go, but they want to go there, so let's do it.
Even though you didn't kind of plan it in that way, did you still have a kind of vague sense of where you wanted the book to end, or kind of where you wanted them to end up? Because hopefully it's not too spoilery to give away that we don't move into 2020 pandemic world. It stops before then, which I imagine you're quite relieved about, that you didn't have to deal with that. But did you have a sense of the kind of overall arc of their stories?
Yes, I was always working around the year and the seasons. That was always my thing. And the one thing I knew from the beginning, I was going to follow a year and the seasons. I think there's two things in there. I personally relate to the seasons a lot, and I was really interested to see of that kind of dynamic and how almost the value of morale seems to change as the seasons change in life in general and our society. And also I think there was a very kind of, I am debuting and writing my first long form piece of writing, and having those, that sense of I'm working towards something, and around a year time made it quite easier for me to conceptualize, and also it was reassuring. I knew where I was going in that sense.
I wanted to ask you about your kind of choices for point of view, because you handle it in a really interesting way, sometimes moving kind of from third person to first, and also using these kind of sections that are italicized that are in the first person. I was wondering kind of how you made those decisions. Did they just kind of feel like a natural switch for you, or did you deliberate over them a bit more?
Yes, there is a lot of instinct in there, and there is a conscious decision I made because I was really interested in that polyphony, actually, and just, you know, and for it not to be too didactic and for me to dictate it too clearly. I was really interesting, as I said earlier, I think it's that idea of the texture of the everyday and how we all see it so differently, and the prism for which we see the same event will be quite determinant on how you're going to retell it next. And that can change over time, that can change with whoever you have around you. And I felt having such a fluidity in point of view was really important to show that without being too intrusive, because as we also just said, they are their people. And, you know, I disagree with them most of the time, but also I disagree with myself most of the time, to be honest. Like, you know, it's just, it's constant, it's changing. And it's in a world that's so, I believe, and I hope it comes across ingrained that just every day. And so, yeah, sometimes it's actually quite mundane and quite futile and, you know, frivolous. Tomorrow you will forget about how you felt about that yesterday. But you still did. And I do believe that it just stays in you as well. And it just becomes this kind of tiny little scars. And they can be happy ones. They can be more painful ones. They, you know, they can become sorrow and they can become joy. But so it's a very unwise answer to say that I wasn't planning it line by line, but I was aware of what I was doing. The thing that came later in the process was to give actual first person chapter to Sophie and Julia. They didn't have it at the very beginning. And I'm not sure why, actually, because now I can't quite see why I wouldn't give them an opportunity to speak for themselves. Actually, the idea just makes me a bit shaky not to do it. Maybe it's just it took me longer to hear them. And that's probably the answer, actually. But yeah, that's probably the biggest thing that didn't come until very later, at quite a late stage in the process.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
There's a moment in the novel that I don't want to spoil, but if you are happy to talk about it, I'll include it. But if anyone hasn't read The Yellow Kitchen and wants to go in completely spoiler free, skip this section. I wanted to ask about the moment when Sophie and Claude sleep together and what you kind of wanted to explore between them and how that kind of that moment happens, but also how it changes things between them, but also the kind of group dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, for the group dynamic, I think that the easiest answer for me here is that kind of, you know, looking at the idea of a threesome and that someone will always feel a little bit out of it. Because I think in some way in our kind of Western societies, we are so compartmentalized to just do everything in pair. Everything has to be in pair, you know, as if you always need to have someone to check on you. And that's, you know, your shadow, making sure you're doing it properly, you're conforming, and you have someone there to like hold you accountable. When there is a third person, that just switches totally. And there is like that kind of thing that's always itching or patting on your back and being like, you know, there is this other opportunity. So that was kind of a very literal and quite frankly physical way of doing it, of excluding Julia from that. She did not have any physical encounter in that threesome. She wasn't there. There is also something of Claude and Julia having that lifelong friendship, which Julia does not have with them. She only met them as an adult. Yeah. So that was kind of a way to look at that dynamic in a very literal way. And then in terms of Claude and Sophie, getting them together to actually have sex was a way for me to interrogate how we navigate and how we interrogate relationships in our lives. I do, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about friendship, and to me, as much as I've been thinking about them, they're just love relationship. And somehow one of the things people always say, if you ask them what is the difference, they will always say, well, I don't sleep with my friends. Mm. Now, like, well, why not? You know, I don't want to just be like, they'll be like, okay, but why not? At the end of the day, you know, it's a form of love as well, right? Mm. It's just showing it in a different ways. But I tell my friends, I love you constantly. And so I do to my partner. And it was just really interesting to see what happened there and how somehow, you know, you also often hear once you've had sex is different. And I just want to understand why. And well, they had to do it. It was a way to go there and to try to interrogate this. It's actually the first time someone asked me blank out what I've done. It's really interesting to talk about.
I guess because people don't want to spoil it, but I just was really interested because like you say, it is kind of pushing the barrier of friendship, and you know, and wondering how it kind of changes things for them. And I think that makes it so interesting. Did you know that was always going to happen between them when you started writing?
Yes, it's probably the first thing I knew. That was the first thing in my head. I knew Claude existed, and I know she was about to have sex with her best mate. That was probably my one-liner in my head when I said to write. I actually started writing a short story about it, and then Claude just invaded me, and she had to make me write a novel. So it's quite cool to blame that one for this one. But yeah, that was actually the first thing that was in my mind.
I'd love to talk a bit more about your kind of writing career and your interest in writing. And one of the obvious things that I have to ask you about is your experience of writing in a second language, because I mean, like, I can't even imagine that kind of as a challenge. And I was interested to know, is there any kind of moments where you're really frustrated because there's a word that exists in French but not in English? So tell us what it's like to write a novel in a second language.
It's freeing. It's it's, you know, it's, well, you kind of can't get it wrong because you can't get it right anyway. Like, you know, it will just never be your mother tongue. It's so different. And as much as I resented that for years, actually, it just, you know, terrified me. But then once I was just like, well, actually, can't go wrong. You know, I'm here. I'm an imposter, to be quite honest. How I felt about it. Let's just do it. And that was just amazing. And you know, there are things I will never be able to claim, and that's probably that very that relationship to vocabulary that you have when it's your mother tongue, your first language. And this I will never be able to have that, but I will always actually be able to question language in a very different ways. And I think that way is essential, because that's how I learned English. On the go, by doing things, by meeting people, by cooking, and that was quite amazing. Yeah, don't get me wrong, it went with a lot of frustrations and fears, and this still out there. You know, I will do some very random double check of grammar and whatever. But it was also an amazing experience, and yeah, I don't think I could have written that novel in French anyways, so I had to write it in English.
Have you attempted writing a novel in French?
No.
No, okay.
I stopped using my French language like quite a long time ago. I mean, obviously, you know, I speak it and I can write it. It's not a problem in the everyday life, but I've never considered myself a writer in French. Mm-hmm. That's something that only came with the English language.
Well, that's just so fascinating to me. And I read an interview with you where you said that writing actually about food was the thing that helped you build your confidence when writing in English. So can you tell us about kind of your writing life? Where did your love of writing begin? I mean, I know you said you don't think of yourself as someone who would write in French, but you love literature and language and writing. So where did it all begin for you?
Thank you, because starting in my head. I was a very quiet child, and just had very difficult relationship with language in general. And quite interestingly, I'm a very late reader. You know, I have no memory of reading children's books. And there was no books in my house, actually. Something I started reading very late, like very later on in life. But when I started, my mind just blew. I was like, oh my God, like, you know, these people. And maybe it's just because I was so in my head and quite, and I don't like saying lonely child, because it made me feel like as if, you know, I was a bit sad. I don't think I was, but I was just alone in my head. And accidentally, there was a lot of people with me in my head that weren't just the product of my own imagination. And I was just amazing. And I started reading a lot. And then when I came to the UK, I had this amazing privilege of learning a language as an adult. And it just gives you a whole new opportunity of like getting a whole new lexicon, and you're in control of it because you know who you are. And learning a language when you know who you are is just, it's just amazing, because the grammar just becomes so much more personal and central, and it just allows you to go in new places. And I don't know, I think it was a really big breakthrough for me to be given this opportunity. First, because I had felt so bad about my relationship with French, and the fact that I always felt as much as I failed actually to be good and to be eloquent and to be a good writer and reader in French. I felt it was my time to do it now on my ground, at my rhythm, and the way I wanted to do it. And it actually just transpired in the end of me writing. And now I just can't imagine my life without writing, even non-fiction or fiction.
And was The Yellow Kitchen your kind of first attempt at writing a novel? Or had you, I mean, like you said, you kind of thought about writing bits of it as a short story. Had you kind of played around with the idea of writing a novel before that?
In my dreams, yes. I never thought I would be able to do it. I was writing a lot of, I went through a year of writing a lot of short stories, bits and bobs, and always just writing quite a lot of essays and that kind of things. But yeah, The Yellow Kitchen is really the first time I sat at my desk thinking I'm gonna try to write a novel now. It's gonna happen.
And what was your process like to get an agent? Because I know you work in the industry already. I will speak about that in a second. But what was your experience like of getting an agent and then going on submission with this novel?
It was actually a really happy story, because I found Kirsty very, very fast. She was really, really quick at responding to me, which for my nerves was the best thing. But I went through the process of just looking online at every single agent. And when I started with the authors I could relate to and I really enjoyed their work, and then I started to look at who represent them. And then I look at those agents, and I went through that, and I just, you know, I know it's really, if there is any kind of writers who are querying right now out there listening, I know it's so harrowing and stressful. And I think starting with people who represent authors you really value and you rate and relate to is a really comforting way of doing it, because, you know, if they found a way to work with those people, then you probably can as well. And I think I always saw that kind of agent relationship as having someone I can work with. Maybe it's a bit skeptical of me, and you know, but I wasn't looking for a friend. I wasn't looking for that type of relationship. I was really looking for someone with whom I can work, and with whom I can trust to speak about my writing. And you know, it's really important to get on and to find someone you feel compatible with in terms of character and everything. But I was really looking for that kind of very crux. The crux for me was that someone with whom I can work and I can trust. So I started that way, and I just submitted to a few people, and yeah, I sent sample chapters to Kirsty, and she responded within a few days to me. So it was love at first sight, even though I just working relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to so many people, and so many of us have had that experience where Finding an agent is like dating, where you've got to find your kind of perfect match and have that kind of rapport from them. And I think a lot of the time it is that gut feeling. And to reference what you said about finding other authors that you think your work is either similar to or thematically kind of fits together, always look in the acknowledgements, because agent is normally the first person that that author will thank. So if you're not sure who that person's agent is, always go to the acknowledgements, and then you can kind of start from there. So how long was it then between signing with your agent to your book deal?
3 months, I think.
Wow. Wow, that is quick.
Yeah, it was a very quick few months. Anyway, we were in full lockdown because it was October 2020. Mm-hmm. So I never met Kirsty in person. We had a lot of phone calls and stuff like that. And then it all happened again through, you know, via home. Then I never met my editor for months. And it was just, you know, it all happened in a bubble. That was really odd. But yes, it was in that time for me, in terms of pace and time, it was a really happy story. And I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah. It's always nice when it has a kind of quick resolution as well. I think it's a very nerve-wracking time. And if you're waiting months and months, it could be a pretty horrible experience, but it's nice that it kind of happened quickly for you. So tell us a little bit about your day job, because you work as a translation rights agent. So what has it been like for you to be on the other side of the process as an author? Has it made you kind of think of your job differently? I don't know, what's it been like for you?
Mm-hmm. It's been an experience. This is going to sound odd because I don't think anyone wants to feel about this time as a happy time, but I felt lucky it happened during lockdown because it really helped me to remove myself a little bit more from having that dual experience. And from the get-go, I just made a very clear promise with myself. When I write, when it's about that, I don't work in publishing. I don't have that knowledge. I don't know how it works. And then when I agent, I don't think about my writing. And I think it's the only way for me to do it healthily. I could probably benefit from both sides if I was a bit more fluid and like exchanging knowledge, but I just can't. I have to compartmentalize. Otherwise, I'm not saying I did it successfully all the time, but I'm really consciously trying to do it, because otherwise it's too much. It's too many books. It's too much stress from other people, me, everyone. It's too much. And I just can't do anything well if I do that. So I've had to be quite strict with myself. And even, you know, when talking with my agent and all of it, I always say, just think I don't know. I just don't know. Mm-hmm. That's really important for me to do it that way. But yes, otherwise I do work as well for an agency, but I work on the translation side. So I work with I represent writers who write mainly in English and sell their rights so they can be translated around the world. So in that sense, though, I did have a distance. I actually know very little about the UK publishing industry, even though I'm ingrained in it. My knowledge is much, I know much more about the French, the Italian publishing industry than I do about the UK one in the end. So that helped as well a little bit.
So it didn't kind of take away your, I guess, anxiety of the process, because that was still slightly unfamiliar to you?
You know, yes. I mean, I think he allowed me to rationalize a lot of things. And I think the biggest problem about publishing is silence. It's because everyone is so overworked. And also, like, a project will take a lot of time, right? If you think about when you sign your contract for your book, and then by the time it's out, 2 years have passed. It's a very long time. So your editor is not going to be talking to you all the time. Most of the time, actually, nothing happens. And then suddenly in 3 weeks, it's bang, 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 bang. You have to re-deliver. Something is going on. And, you know, and what's really hard is the silence in between. I can feel that here. I think that's probably my biggest luck. I knew why I was being silent most of the time. And I could rationalize and, you know, not make it about me and it being personal. You know, people weren't ignoring Margot the author. No, they were just living their life and it's fine. So yes, it did allow me though to have a bit of a calmer approach of the overall process, because I knew how it works. you know, I know how the book becomes that hard bag at the end with you holding in your hands. But it didn't take away any of the kind of, you know, that personal, you know, how somehow when it comes to your writing, everything becomes so, I mean, at least for me, like really narrow and personal, you know, these days, it's still very, very much scary.
So that's one thing you learned in the process, but is there anything else you've learned during publication that you wish you'd known like way back when, even before you started writing The Yellow Kitchen? If there's anything that you think, oh, I wish I'd known that, I would have made my experience easier or calmer, what would it be?
Yeah, gosh, pretty much everything. But at the same time, I still wish I knew nothing, because I don't think I would have written the book otherwise. Like,
really?
Yeah, I think it was good not to know. And it was nice actually to be a bit naive, and to think, oh, it's going to come together. You know, it's going to be fine. That was nice. That was, I really enjoyed that. At least for a first novel, I think though it's really important to go away and think about how did you write that novel? How did you edit it? I think that's probably the biggest thing for me, was having that experience of editorial with someone, and try to take something away from that. Approaching like other pieces of work now, I think that's how you go away from, you know, just passing from book one into book two or other works or something like that. So so I took away a lot, I think, in terms of, you know, progress and longer term, and trying to approach the next step and it not just being the same again, but I'm glad I knew little.
So finally, can you tell us about this book two, this new thing that you're working on at the moment?
Well, I am working on something and I'm editing it now, and I'm actually really excited about, which is really nice. I'm at that phase where I'm getting to know my people in there, and it's really lovely because I miss having those little friends of my own. So it's really fun, and I hope I can announce something fairly shortly, but it should happen again.
Well, have you been texting yourself messages from your characters again?
A lot. A lot of texting, a lot of writing a letter at some point, you know, those kind of things. But it's good. It's good.
Love to hang it. I think this is going to be a little technique that other people are going to steal now, and our phones are going to be full of these weird messages that are not in our own voice, and that should be really fun.
Yes. The notes app as well work really well, this kind of thing. So
yeah, my notes app is full. It's just absolutely full with, and sometimes I don't know about you, but I'll scroll back and I'm like, I don't even understand what this means, but it must have been important at one point.
Yes, between this and random passwords that I should not save in there, it's a it's a great place to be.
Well, Margot, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That was Margot Villeron talking about her literary novel, The Yellow Kitchen, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it'd be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.